One of the major stories of 2017 is how the Trump administration began moving forward on its hardline immigration policies. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The policies President Trump implemented in 2017 have affected U.S.-Mexico relations and immigrants. Maureen Cavanaugh of KPBS sat down with her colleague, Fronteras reporter Jean Guerrero, for a roundup on the border stories she covered this year and a look ahead to 2018.
The new Trump border wall project is still in its early stages with no clear source of funding. But you and KPBS partner iNewsSource decided to examine past efforts to construct a border wall. The report was called America's Wall. Can you remind us about the takeaways from that project?
One of the most surprising findings of our series was that 97% of the current wall was built under the Obama, Bush, and Clinton administration. So it's pretty new. Most of it was actually built after 2005, which is the year that the government passed a law saying that you could build a border wall essentially without paying attention to environmental regulations. And that allowed construction efforts to happen very, very quickly after 2005. The other key finding was that as we saw the wall go up, we saw significant decreases in illegal cross-border traffic wherever it was built. But at the same time, you saw a very dramatic rerouting of that traffic into other areas. So into the desert, where there is no wall, for example, in parts of Arizona and parts of Texas, into the ocean, into underground through illegal cross-border tunnels, and also into the sky, which is the most recent way of smuggling drugs through drones.
So Trump's border wall project is just at its beginning stages. What's been accomplished this year?
8 prototypes for what the border wall might look like were finished in October. And the testing phase is actually over, but the testing is being evaluated currently. They were tested for how well they resist climbing, how well they resist tunneling underground. And now the results of those tests are being evaluated. And President Trump very recently said that he may visit the site of the prototypes here in San Diego.
Now, the prototypes have been funded, but there's still no funding for the larger project of the wall. Is that right?
Exactly. There's still no money either from Congress. There was $1.6 billion requested to start the wall, and that was approved by the House but not by the Senate. And we still have not seen any money from Mexico, as the president had promised during his campaign, nor is there any indication that Mexico would pay for the wall.
Now, you reported on 4 families who were separated by Immigration and Customs Enforcement when seeking asylum in the U.S. Can you remind us of the stories of those families?
Right. So these are families that were fleeing violence in El Salvador, 3 of them from El Salvador, 1 from Honduras. They were fathers who crossed the border alone with their children. Their wives stayed behind for a variety of reasons. One was a man who actually lost his wife in Mexico. They were crossing together, and when they were trying to flee Mexican migration authorities, they lost sight of each other, and the wife ended up crossing the border through another area. But my story focused on one of those men in particular, Jose de Mar Fuentes. His 1-year-old son was taken away from him by immigration authorities. He had crossed alone while his wife stayed behind in Mexico because at the time they didn't have enough money for all 4 to cross at the same time. And they were very worried about the boy's health because they'd been traveling for weeks on top of Mexico's infamous train, La Bestia, on the roof of that train. And the boy was very dehydrated, so they decided to split up. And the father crossed with the child. They were all under the impression that immigration authorities would not separate a father and a 1-year-old child, but in fact they did. And what immigration officials say that they separated them because they didn't have enough documentary proof that they were the fathers of the children. So they were taking the safety of the children into consideration because smugglers often pair children with non-parents to get them across. What's very interesting and complicated about this case is Fuentes insists that he had his son's original birth certificate and his own Salvadoran ID. I saw copies of both of those documents, which the father had scanned prior to the crossing, but he remains in detention, and his son is in a shelter more than 1,500 miles away in Texas.
Is there any indication that this is a new strategy being used to deter immigration into the U.S.?
Right. So the New York Times and the Washington Post both reported that the Department of Homeland Security and White House officials say that the Trump administration is considering a policy to separate families in detention, as we've already seen happening. But they're apparently thinking about making this a policy to deter families from coming from Central America as a deterrence strategy, which is something that we've never seen before, to have a policy that tries to scare off families, because what they hope will happen is that word will spread that if they come across, their children will be taken away, and that will potentially discourage people from making the journey at all. But the Homeland Security Secretary has yet to sign off on the policy. Regardless, it already appears to be a practice, not just from the cases that I reported, but many other cases documented by immigrant rights groups along the border.
Now, early in 2017, you went to Mexico City with a delegation from San Diego. That trip resulted in a memorandum being signed with Mexico's Senate. What did they agree to in that memorandum?
They agreed that they would collaborate on Mexican legislation that affects ports of entry, immigration, and trade. To my knowledge, no legislation has been passed in Mexico to address any of those issues. However, we have seen new vehicle lanes at the San Ysidro Port of Entry that are currently under construction, and the speed with which that project has been unfolding could be attributable to the relationships that were established on that trip.
Do you expect to start seeing the results of that memorandum in next year, 2018?
That's actually somewhat unlikely. Mexico has presidential elections next year, and this is expected to change everything about the relationship between the United States and Mexico. There's a lot of resentment right now in Mexico about President Trump's comments about Mexico. There's also a lot of resentment against the current ruling party, which has been seen as being too friendly with the U.S. So a lot of political experts in Mexico believe that this time a nationalist candidate is going to win the presidency, which would potentially drive the U.S. and Mexico farther apart in terms of trade, in terms of collaboration on pretty much anything, even the drug war or national security.
That was Fronteras reporter Jean Guerrero speaking with her KPBS colleague Maureen Cavanaugh. U.S. border officials are working a backlog of asylum requests at the U.S.-California border. The number of people fleeing persecution in their home countries is so large that officials have not been able to process them all. That has left some stranded and running out of money while they wait in Tijuana. Last week, as many as 100 immigrants lined up at Ped West, the pedestrian border crossing that opened earlier this year. If they don't have documents for entry, Customs and Border Protection officials interview, photograph, and fingerprint them, then check law enforcement databases. If the immigrant says he or she is afraid to return to his or her home country, CBP is required by law to transfer that migrant to other federal agencies for a potential asylum case. Asylum seekers, like refugees, must prove that they've been persecuted or fear persecution because of their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. If they don't pass the interviews, they're sent back home. If they pass, many stay in detention for the remainder of their cases, which can take a year or more to finalize. A San Antonio artist is turning an area in the Alamo City, considered a no man's land, into a work of art. A massive new sculpture is nearing completion on the city's southwest side, one of the few large works of public art in the area. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan spoke with its creator, Cruz Ortiz, who says the sculpture pays homage to myth, folklore, and family.
The first thing you notice about I-35 at South Zarzamora is the incessant din of traffic. This place is designed only for cars and trucks. No trees, no sidewalks, nothing on the human scale. But now a twisted, vaguely teepee-shaped piece of art has added a very human touch. Artist Cruz Ortiz describes the project's origins.
He came up to me and was just like, hey, I have this crazy idea. I'm like, I like crazy ideas.
That he was City Councilman Ray Saldana, who had gotten a call from a District 4 resident.
Who said, you really need to do something about this corner. It's messy, it's dirty.
That corner is a triangular shape of no man's land with I-35 on one side, Zarzamora on the other, and a railroad track on the third. Saldana told the resident he'd find out who owned it and compel him to improve the property. But the investigation revealed something unexpected.
The people who owned it was us. The city actually owned the property.
Saldana was able to score two federal community development block grants, which was enough to clean up the corner and also to create something impressive. Art.
We found an artist named Cruz Ortiz who lives on the south side, does a lot of great work, and his work is displayed in, you know, fancy restaurants and art galleries that may be out of reach for the community in my neighborhood. And so I was delighted to hear that he was interested.
When he told me where it was, I was like, wow, okay. This is like probably one of the busiest intersections on the south side.
This location was both its biggest detriment and its most compelling reason to do the job.
The south side, to my knowledge, doesn't have a major cultural art institution.
You don't see a lot of public art south of Highway 90.
And so Ortiz was secured to create something that would humanize this place, where only the combustion engine ruled. But what to create?
Whatever we make, it's got to be really tall. This is an area that no one walks through. And I also wanted to use the metal that the neighborhood has seen before. So like oil rigs, trucks, the Air Force bases. You see these mega huge C-5s going in the air. I'm like, that's a huge chunk of metal.
Those elements are important, but they're all just structural.
Then the other component was the folklore, looking at the myth, the beauty of families carrying on stories.
He's talking about the fanciful family stories passed on generation to generation by grandma. Abuelita.
And it references a lot of that, like the lechuza story, which is this big bird owl. Now, if you didn't come inside, she's going to cuss you out and scratch you, so you need to get in.
So Ortiz cut out and hung big metal lechuzas on the 70-foot tower.
The sculpture also has these big claws that are on top of the pylons. They're red chicken feet, which refer to the dancers at El Camaroncito, which is also on the southwest side.
As the story goes, an attractive man enters El Camaroncito and elegantly dances with all the women, one by one.
The boyfriends are like, dude, what's going on? And it hits midnight, and he dips the last girl. And she looks down, and she notices that he has chicken feet. And, of course, everyone goes in a startle. They come to get him, and he disappears.
He was, of course, the devil. And the story's particulars are devised to give the young chills every time they hear them. Stories created for the same reason stories are created the world over, to get kids to do what their elders want them to.
It's really just Grandma or Abuelita telling me, you need to get your butt home. Like, it's time to get home.
Back at the sculpture, its south side is dominated by text in the quirky woodblock print style that Ortiz is known for. And what it says is at the heart of this art.
Siempre dreaming of you, which means I'm always dreaming of you. And that's the other thing, too. Like, I think about the people who go to work every day. Like, they get up at 5 o'clock, are working, you know, probably on the north side, and they drive back tired and exhausted. And all those people are doing it for what? They want to take care of their families.
And so this sculpture, the Dream Song Tower, is largely a love letter to the people who power his creativity. And he hopes the massive creation will inspire them to fulfill their own dreams.
And so that's what this project is about. It's about the myth and folklore, the beauty of family, the beauty of everyone coming together and appreciating each other.
Ortiz's sculpture arches high over the windblown intersection. The city will complete the project in early February with three-point nighttime lighting to make it a beacon for an area where hope, as manifested in public art, has long been neglected. Jack Morgan, Texas Public Radio News.
You can see pictures of Ortiz and his creation at tpr.org. Coming up next on Fronteras, a Native American author and illustrator gets children to discover more while reading his book.
Oh, these stars are actually starfish. This meteor is actually a dog bone. It was fun for me to hide all these things in the paintings.
We'll explore that story and the inspiration for creating Latina superheroes after this. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Dreaming is the subject of a new book that tells a story taking place on a night of a million stars and a million dreams. Native American author and illustrator Joel Nakamura takes a sleeping young boy on a journey of shifting identities, landscapes, and experiences. The book, I Dreamed I Was a Dog is Nakamura's follow-up to Go West, his award-winning children's book from 2015. KUNM Spencer Beckwith spoke with the author about his colorful book that helps children discover new things in each picture.
I can imagine parents sharing this book with their kids at bedtime. In your opinion, Joel, what is a bedtime story?
Well, I think a bedtime story is a favorite book that gets read over and over again to where the parent may try to skip a page, but the kid knows and says, hey, you skipped a page. So that's what I want this book to be, is a bedtime favorite. So children can find and discover new things in each picture as they look at it. They go, oh, I didn't see that before. And, oh, these stars are actually starfish. This meteor is actually a dog bone. It was fun for me to hide all these things in the paintings, and for the kids to make those connections was really fun.
Not many children's books use quotes from Schopenhauer as introductions, but this book does. What is the quote, Joel, and why did it appeal to you?
The universe is a dream, dreamed by a single dreamer, but all the characters in the dream are dreaming too. The first time I heard that was from Joseph Campbell to talk about dream mythology and Jungian psychology. And so I did a series of paintings. I think I even did a show based around dream mythologies. Later, it became an idea for a book. And so it's just that people should remember their dreams and not be afraid of their dreams, that dreams can be magical and they can go into very bizarre places. But they're all messages for us from our subconscious. And if we pay attention to these, sometimes we can gain valuable information that we can use in our waking consciousness.
And your illustrations, which are just wonderfully colorful, playful, almost psychedelic, are very believable as dreamscapes. How do you describe your style?
Maybe surrealism, maybe magical realism as a literary metaphor. If you take a writer like Gabriel Garcia Marquez or James Lee Burke, more contemporary, that there's fantastic imagery and things that go on in the book, but it's based in reality. And so I wanted these images to be stylized, but also kind of psychedelic in color and vivid, dreamy.
There's also a sense of tribal art or folk art in there as well. Are those influences also, Joel?
Oh, yeah. Folk art and tribal art are probably my biggest influence. I love folk art because these artists had to create art, and they didn't care if they had training. They just had things they wanted to say about their culture, and they had to do it. To me, that's very authentic art, and I'm always fascinated by what I see at the Folk Art Museum in Santa Fe. It's one of my favorite museums and kind of my muse to go when I don't have ideas. I always get ideas whenever I go there.
That was KUNM's Spencer Beckwith speaking with author-illustrator Joel Nakamura of Santa Fe, New Mexico. A new group of superheroes is coming to town. Just don't expect them to grace your kids' lunchboxes or find them inside a kid's meal. The Super Cheekies don't go around blowing up bad guys, and they don't have typical superhero names. They're named Anna, Samantha, Daniela, Veronica, Indira, and Esperanza. But that's not the point. The fact that they have everyday names makes these preteen characters more relatable to the young girls they hope to inspire. Luz Andrea Diaz is the creator of Super Cheekies. At a recent launch of Super Cheekies in San Antonio's Geekdom Event Center, Diaz says these superheroes are supposed to reflect the city's diversity.
At this company, what we want to do is that we want to have Latinos a new superhero. Superhero girls that are powerful, talented, just like us. And also they portray positive characters. Most of their characters are Latina, and some of them are women of girls of color, minorities, and that's what we are promoting, diversity. We are also promoting tolerance. We are promoting good values, family values too.
Diaz didn't have to go far to find inspiration for her characters. two superheroes are based on her daughters. What is 9-year-old Johanna Velasquez's superpower?
Painting. People can just show me something and I can totally just paint it.
Johanna inspired the Super Chiquis character, Samantha. Her little sister, 7-year-old Angela Velasquez, inspired the character, Anna. Her superpower is singing.
When I sing, whatever I sing comes reality and everything she paints.
She points to her sister, Johanna. Samantha.
Like, if she drops a spider in, a spider just pops out.
And not to leave the parents out, Dia says each comic will come with a companion guide for mom or dad to help them engage with their kids over the lessons learned in each adventure.
Then they can talk to each other, like, did you see how they use their superpower? Do you have any superpowers?
Dia says the young girls who read the comics will come away confident that they are superheroes, too.
Everybody has a different talent, and that is our own superpower, and we can share that with the world.
And Diaz hopes the Super Chiquis will save the day with a little tolerance, diversity, and kindness. That's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced the broadcast. Michelle Dubach is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. And Happy New Year!